in the American political system today that has encouraged the White House to vigorously impose unprecedented secrecy over its activities and to attempt to control the flow of information as a means of controlling the outcome of all important decisions that still lie in the hands of the people. Rather than accepting our traditions of openness and accountability, this administration has opted to rule by unquestioned authority. For this administration, all too often, the truth hurts. It hurts, that is, when it is available to the American people. Consequently, they have often sought relief by depriving the American people of access to information to which they have a right. A government of and for the people is supposed to be generally open to public scrutiny by the people, while the private information of the people themselves should be routinely protected from government intrusion. This administration has turned the fundamental presumption of our democracy on its head. And in the end, its assaults on our core democratic principles have left us less free and less secure. Chapter 5. The Assault on the Individual. Just as the boundary line between the economic sphere and the political sphere has shifted back and forth over time, as noted in Chapter 3, in the same way, the boundary between the individual and the nation has also been drawn differently in different societies and at different periods in history. The new information ecology of the printing press, which empowered individuals to wield knowledge as a source of influence, led to a new recognition of and respect for the role of individuals. You could say that the idea of individual dignity acquired new meaning with the new accessibility of information that arrived in the wake of the printing press. Without printed words and the knowledge conveyed by them to the masses who became literate, there would have been no Bill of Rights in America to protect the freedom and dignity of individuals. In much the same way that the information revolution in the last quarter of the 20th century transformed economic output by substituting ingenuity for raw materials, the total value of everything produced in the American economy grew by 300% from 1950 to 2000, while the gross tonnage remained the same. The information revolution that began in the late 15th century progressively substituted the force of thought for force of arms in the political economy of Europe. As soon as complex thoughts could be easily conveyed from one individual to the mass of others, and as soon as others could easily receive them and potentially agree with them, every individual suddenly had the potential for leveraging mass political power. The free flow of information therefore gave each individual more standing within society, without reference to class or fortune, to claim a measure of dignity equal to all others, and empowered individuals to scrutinize the use of power by those in government. As a result, as long as individuals had access to the public forum on terms equal to, or nearly equal to, those with wealth and power, they could exercise political power and were seen as being entitled to deference by the state. Indeed, by the time of the American Revolution, the state's power came to be seen as legitimate only when it was derived from the consent of the individuals in whose name it was exercised. It was as if every person was entitled to symbolically fly the legendary flag carried by the Marines mustered by the Continental Congress in 1775, "Don't tread on me." Today, by contrast, Americans in the age of television do not have the same means of attracting the attention and agreement of the masses of their fellow citizens for even the most eloquently expressed opinion. Unlike the menacing snake with 13 rattles on the flag more than two centuries ago, individual Americans in the 21st century no longer seem to get the same respect. African Americans, Native Americans, and women were not included in the circle of respect two centuries ago, of course. And in reality, access to the public forum was much more freely available to educated elites than to the average person. Even though literacy rates were high in the late 18th century, illiteracy was a barrier for many then, as it is for many Americans still. Nevertheless, with the dominance of television over the printing press, and the continued infancy of the Internet in its development as a serious competitor to television, we have temporarily lost a common meeting place in the public forum where powerful ideas from individuals have the potential to sway the opinions of millions and generate genuine political change. What has emerged in its place is a very different kind of public forum, one in which individuals are constantly flattered but rarely listened to. When the consent of the governed is manufactured and manipulated by marketers and propagandists, reason plays a diminished role. With each passing month, the Internet is bringing new opportunities for individuals to reassert their historic role in American democracy. Blogs, for example, are now beginning to serve as a check and balance on inaccurate information conveyed by the mass media, and the growing distribution of short video clips over the web is creating more confidence that television will eventually be seen as a transition medium between the age of print and the age of the Internet. Nevertheless, for the time being, television is still by far the most powerful medium, and the sameness of the cleverly designed messages aimed at the mass audience and the lack of genuine interaction undermines and corrodes individualism. As a result, the dignity of individuals in American society has been undermined. Moreover, the diminished role of individuals in America's national conversation has been accompanied by a diminished respect for the rights of individuals, especially during the Bush-Cheney administration. For example, President Bush has declared that he has a heretofore unrecognized inherent power to seize and imprison any American citizen whom he alone determines to be a threat to our nation, without an arrest warrant, without notifying them of what charges have been filed against them, and without even informing their families that they have been imprisoned. The president claims that he can simply snatch an American citizen off the street and keep him or her locked up indefinitely, even for the rest of his or her life, and refuse to allow that citizen the right to make a phone call or talk to a lawyer, even to argue that the president or his appointees have made a mistake and imprisoned the wrong person. All that is necessary to make this move legal, according to the president, is that he label that citizen an unlawful enemy combatant. Those are the magic words. If the president alone decides that those two words accurately describe someone, then that person can be immediately locked up and held incommunicado for as long as the president wants, with no court having the right to determine whether the facts actually justify his imprisonment. These claims have been and are being challenged in court, but so far only with modest success. Now, if the president makes a mistake, or is given faulty information by somebody working for him, and he locks up the wrong person, then it's almost impossible for that prisoner to prove his or her innocence, because he or she can't talk to a lawyer, or family, or anyone else. The prisoner doesn't even have the right to know what specific crime he or she is accused of committing. So a constitutional right to liberty and the pursuit of happiness that we used to think of in an old-fashioned way as inalienable can now be instantly stripped from any American by the president with no meaningful review by any other branch of government. For those in federal custody who do manage to gain legal representation, the current administration has issued regulations authorizing the attorney general to monitor all conversations between the accused and his attorney if the attorney general alone suspects it is necessary. These regulations bypass procedures for obtaining prior judicial review for such monitoring in the rare instances when it was permitted in the past. Now, whoever's in federal custody has to assume that the government could be listening to their consultations with their lawyers. In his famous book, The Trial, Franz Kafka wrote about a fictional prisoner, K, who was put in a predicament eerily similar to circumstances of some held in custody by the Bush-Cheney administration. But K should not forget that the trial would not be public. If the court deems it necessary, it can be made public, but there is no law that says it has to be. As a result, the accused and his defense don't have access even to the court records, and especially not to the indictment. And that means we generally don't know, or at least not precisely, what the first documents need to be about, which means that if they do contain anything of relevance to the case, it's only by a lucky coincidence. If anything about the individual charges and the reasons for them comes out clearly or can be guessed at while the accused is being questioned, then it's possible to work out and submit documents that really direct the issue and present proof, but not before. Conditions like this, of course, place the defense in a very unfavorable and difficult position. but that is what they intend. In fact, defense is not really allowed under the law. It's only tolerated, and there is even some dispute about whether the relevant parts of the law imply even that. So strictly speaking, there is no such thing as a counsel acknowledged by the court, and anyone who comes before this court as counsel is basically no more than a barrack room lawyer. The effect of all this, of course, is to remove the dignity of the whole procedure. As Winston Churchill once put it, "The power of the executive to cast a man into prison without formulating any charge known to the law, and particularly to deny him the judgment of his peers, is in the highest degree odious, and the foundation of all totalitarian government, whether Nazi or communist." The Supreme Court has recently disagreed with the administration's bizarre claim of extra-legal power, but the president engaged in legal maneuvers that have thus far prevented the court from providing any meaningful relief for this abuse. This administration simply does not seem to agree that the challenge of preserving democratic freedom cannot be met by surrendering core American values. Incredibly, this administration has attempted to compromise the most precious rights that America has stood for all over the world for more than 200 years: due process, equal treatment under the law, the dignity of the individual, freedom from unreasonable search and seizure, freedom from promiscuous government surveillance. For example, when America was founded, individual citizens were protected by the Bill of Rights from unreasonable search and seizure. During America's first two centuries, if the police wanted to search your house, they had to be able to persuade an independent judge to give them a search warrant, and then, with rare exceptions, they had to bang on your door and yell, "Open up." If you didn't quickly open up, they were then permitted to knock down the door. Also, if they seized anything, they had to leave a list explaining what they had taken. That way, if it was all a terrible mistake, as it sometimes is, you could go and get your stuff back. But that's all changed now. Starting a few years ago, federal agents were given broad new statutory authority by the Patriot Act to sneak and peek in non-terrorism cases. They can secretly enter your home with no warning, whether you are there or not, and they can wait for months before telling you they were there. Such searches need not have any relationship to terrorism whatsoever. They can be triggered by any garden variety crime. And the new law makes it very easy to get around the need for a traditional warrant. Agents simply need to say that searching your house might have some connection, even a remote one, to the investigation of some agent of a foreign power. Then they can go to another court, a secret court, that has rejected only 4 warrant applications of the more than 18,000 filed. In a speech at FBI headquarters, President Bush went even further and formally proposed that the Attorney General be allowed to authorize these special subpoenas by administrative order without the need for a warrant from any court. Here's another recent change in our civil liberties. Now, if it wants to, the federal government has the right to monitor every website you go to on the Internet, keep a list of everyone you send email to or receive email from, and everyone you call on the telephone or who calls you. And it doesn't even have to show probable cause that you've done anything wrong. Nor does the government ever have to report to any court on what it's doing with the information. Moreover, there are precious few safeguards to keep the government from reading the content of all your email. As a matter of fact, the current administration also claims the right to read all the mail you receive from the U.S. Postal Service and to listen to all your telephone calls as well, if it chooses to do so. Administration officials promise not to do it unless they have a really good reason. But they get to decide on their own what constitutes a good reason, and they don't need permission from a judge. That comes as a surprise to those who are familiar with the U.S. Constitution. The courts have always recognized an inherent presidential authority in rare emergency cases to conduct surveillance and searches that would otherwise require a warrant. What is different is that this president claims the right to break and enter, tap your phone, and read your correspondence at will, and to do so regularly for a significant number of Americans on a massive scale. Whenever critics of this practice point out that it constitutes a historic weakening of the individual rights guaranteed to Americans under the Constitution, this administration accuses them of coddling terrorists. But an increasing number of Americans in both political parties, have expressed concern that the Bush policy will serve to set a precedent for future presidents to routinely violate the individual rights that are protected in the Constitution. Many fear that if the pattern of practice begun by this administration is not challenged, it may well become a permanent part of the American system. A few principled conservatives have pointed out that granting unchecked power to this president might well mean that the next president will have unchecked power as well, and they are well aware that the next president might be someone whose values and beliefs they do not share. The United States Congress, while it was under Republican control, passed a law that clarified the procedures that must be followed by the executive branch to protect privacy of letters delivered by the U.S. Postal Service. But the president issued a written statement at the time he signed the law, emphasizing his own independent authority to order, without a warrant, that mail be opened for inspection. As James Madison, the principal author of the Constitution, wrote, "There are more instances of the abridgment of the freedom of the people by the gradual and silent encroachments of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations." Or to cite another change, and thanks to the librarians, more people know about this one. The White House has claimed the right to send the FBI into any library and ask for the records of anybody who has used the library and get a list of who is reading what, simply by claiming the information is relevant to an intelligence investigation. They have even claimed the power to compel the librarians to be silent about the request, lest the librarians themselves also be imprisoned, although a court ruled that this gag order was unconstitutional, and Congress has since changed it. Similarly, the FBI can demand all the records of banks, colleges, hotels, hospitals, credit card companies, and many more kinds of companies. The administration has also claimed the right to run credit and background checks and gather other information about anyone the government decides is of investigatory interest, meaning anyone the administration thinks is suspicious, even without any evidence of criminal behavior. The administration has further authorized FBI agents to attend church meetings, rallies, political meetings, and any other citizen activity open to the public simply on the agent's own initiative, reversing a decades-old policy that required justification to supervisors that such an infiltration has a provable connection to a legitimate investigation. As we now know, the executive branch of our government has been caught eavesdropping on huge numbers of American citizens and has brazenly declared that it has the unilateral right to continue without regard to the established law enacted by Congress to prevent such abuses. It is imperative that respect for the rule of law be restored. Why should we be alarmed about such eavesdropping? Recall that for the last several years of his life, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was illegally wiretapped, one of hundreds of thousands of Americans whose private communications were intercepted by the U.S. government during this period. The FBI privately called King the most dangerous and effective Negro leader in the country and vowed to take him off his pedestal. The government even attempted to destroy his marriage and allegedly tried to blackmail him into committing suicide. This campaign continued until Dr. King's murder. In fact, it was the discovery that the FBI had conducted a long-running and extensive campaign of secret electronic surveillance designed to infiltrate the inner workings of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and to learn the most intimate details of Dr. King's life that helped persuade Congress to enact new statutory restrictions on wiretapping in the first place. The result of these and other similar abuses was the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, which was enacted expressly to ensure that foreign intelligence surveillance would be presented to an impartial judge to verify that there is a sufficient cause for the surveillance. I voted for that law during my first term in Congress, and for almost 30 years, the system has proven a workable and valued means of according a level of protection for private citizens while permitting foreign surveillance to continue. Then in December of 2005, Americans suddenly awoke to the shocking news that in spite of this long-settled law, the executive branch has been secretly spying on large numbers of Americans for more than 4 years, and eavesdropping on a huge number of telephone calls and emails inside the United States, without any search warrants or new legal authority. During the period when this eavesdropping was still secret, the president went out of his way to reassure the American people on more than one occasion that, of course, judicial permission is required for any government spying on American citizens, and that, of course, these constitutional safeguards were still in place. The president's soothing statements turned out to be knowingly false. Moreover, as soon as this massive domestic spying program was uncovered by the press, the president not only confirmed that the story was true, but also declared that he had no intention of bringing these wholesale invasions of privacy to an end. At present, we still have much to learn about a more recent statement in the aftermath of the change in control of Congress that the White House would begin to abide by FISA. But the imposition of secrecy on all of the legal proceedings is not reassuring, and what we do know about this pervasive wiretapping leads to the unavoidable conclusion that the President of the United States has been breaking the law repeatedly and persistently. Attorney General Gonzalez wrote that the administration still believes the program is legal, but that they have now gone to the FISA court and that a judge on the court has set rules that preserve the speed and agility necessary to battle terrorism. Neither Gonzalez nor Justice Department officials disclosed details of the rules set by the court, arguing that details were classified. So it is unclear whether the administration is getting individualized approval as required by FISA, or rather has received some broader authority. The presiding judge of the FISA court said she was willing to release the ruling, but the administration has objected on the grounds that the orders include classified information. The administration's handling of this issue is in keeping with its tendency to try to render controversies moot by making small concessions in their practice without conceding on the larger principle at stake. The president's men have minced words about America's laws. The attorney general openly conceded that the kind of surveillance we now know they have been conducting requires a court order unless authorized by statute. FISA self-evidently does not authorize what the National Security Agency has been doing, and no one inside or outside the administration claims that it does. Incredibly, the administration claims instead that the surveillance was implicitly authorized when Congress voted to approve the use of force against those who attacked us on September 11th. This argument just does not hold water and faces a number of embarrassing facts. First, another admission by Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. He concedes that the administration knew that the NSA project was prohibited by existing law and that it consulted with some members of Congress about changing the statute. Gonzalez says that the administration was told this probably would not be possible. So it stretches credibility for the administration to subsequently claim that the authorization for the use of military force somehow implicitly authorized the NSA project all along. Second, when the authorization was being debated, the administration members did, in fact, seek to have language inserted in it that would have authorized them to use military force domestically, and the Congress did not agree. Senator Ted Stevens, Republican, Arkansas, and Representative Jim McGovern, Democrat, Massachusetts, among others, made statements during the authorization debate clearly restating that that authorization did not operate domestically. It is the administration's disrespect for America's Constitution that has now brought our republic to the brink of a dangerous breach in the fabric of democracy. And the disrespect embodied in these apparent mass violations of the law is part of a larger pattern of seeming indifference to the Constitution that is deeply troubling to millions of Americans in both political parties. Thomas Paine, whose pamphlet Common Sense helped ignite the American Revolution, succinctly described America's alternative. Here, he said, we intended to make certain that the law is king. Vigilant adherence to the rule of law strengthens our democracy and strengthens America. It ensures that those who govern us operate within our constitutional structure, which means that our democratic institutions play their indispensable role in shaping policy and determining the direction of our nation. It means that the people of this nation ultimately determine its course, and not executive officials operating in secret without constraint. The rule of law makes us stronger by ensuring that decisions will be tested, studied, reviewed, and examined through the processes of government that are designed to improve policy. And the knowledge that they will be reviewed prevents overreaching and checks the accretion of power. By the same token, whenever power is unchecked and unaccountable, it almost inevitably leads to mistakes and abuses. In the absence of rigorous accountability, incompetence flourishes. Dishonesty is encouraged and rewarded. In January 2006, for example, Vice President Cheney attempted to defend the administration's eavesdropping on American citizens by saying that if it had conducted this program prior to 9/11, it would have found out the names of some of the hijackers. Tragically, he apparently still doesn't know that the administration members did in fact have the names of at least two of the hijackers well before 9/11 and had available to them information that could have easily led to the identification of most of the other hijackers. Yet because of incompetence in the handling of this information, it was never used to protect the American people. There was in fact a great deal of specific information that was available prior to 9/11. That probably could have been used to prevent the tragedy. A recent analysis by the Markle Foundation, working with data from a software company that received venture capital from a CIA-sponsored firm, demonstrates this point in a startling way. In late August 2001, Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khaled Almodar bought tickets to fly on American Airlines Flight 77, which was flown into the Pentagon. They bought the tickets using their real names. Both names were then on a State Department INS watch list called Tip-Off. Both men were sought by the FBI and CIA as suspected terrorists, in part because they had been observed at a terrorist meeting in Malaysia. These two passenger names would have been exact matches when checked against the Tip-Off list, but that would only have been the first step. Further data checks could then have begun. Checking for common addresses, address information is widely available, including on the internet. Analysts would have discovered that Salim al-Hazmi, who also bought a seat on American Airlines Flight 77, used the same address as Nawaf al-Hazmi. More important, they could have discovered that Mohammed Atta, American Airlines Flight 11, North Tower of the World Trade Center, and Marwan al-Shihi, United Airlines Flight 175, South Tower of the World Trade Center, used the same address as Khaled Almodar. Checking for identical frequent flyer numbers, analysts would have discovered that Majed Moket, American Airlines Flight 77, used the same number as Almodar. With Mohammed Atta, now also identified as a possible associate of the wanted terrorist Almodar, analysts could have added Atta's phone numbers, also publicly available information, to their checklist. By doing so, they would have identified four other hijackers: Fayez Ahmed, Mohanad al-Shahiri, Wael al-Shahiri, and Abdulaziz al-Omari. Closer to September 11th, a further check of passenger lists against a more innocuous INS watch list for expired visas would have identified Ahmed al-Ghamdi. Through him, the same sort of relatively simple correlations could have led to identifying the remaining hijackers who boarded United Airlines Flight 93, which crashed in Pennsylvania. This analysis from the Markle Foundation clearly demonstrates that all of the necessary raw data was available to stop the 9/11 attacks. In the next chapter, I will explain that the relevant officials at the FBI and CIA were aware of much of this information and yet were stymied in their efforts to get the White House to pay attention to it. Not to put too fine a point on it, what is needed is better and more timely analysis. Simply piling up more raw data that is almost entirely irrelevant is not only not going to help, it may actually hurt the cause. As one of the nation's top security technologists, Bruce Schneier, said, "We're looking for a needle in a haystack here. Dumping more hay on the pile doesn't necessarily get you anywhere." In other words, The mass collecting of personal data on hundreds of millions of people actually makes it more difficult to protect the nation against terrorists, so they ought to cut most of it out. There have, of course, been other periods in American history when the executive branch claimed new powers that were later seen as excessive and mistaken. Our second president, John Adams, passed the infamous Alien and Sedition Acts and sought to silence and imprison critics and political opponents. When his successor, Thomas Jefferson, eliminated the abuses, he said, "The essential principles of our government form the bright constellation which has gone before us and guided our steps through an age of revolution and reformation. Should we wander from them in moments of error or of alarm, let us hasten to retrace our steps and to regain the road which alone leads to peace, liberty, and safety." Our greatest president, Abraham Lincoln, suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War. Some of the worst abuses prior to those of the current administration were committed by President Woodrow Wilson during and after World War I with the notorious Red Scare and Palmer Raids. The internment of Japanese Americans during World War II marked a low point for the respect of individual rights at the hands of the executive. Then came the McCarthy abuses of the Cold War. And during the Vietnam War, the notorious COINTELPRO program was part and parcel of the abuses experienced by Dr. King and thousands of others. But in each of these cases, when the conflict and turmoil subsided, the country recovered its equilibrium and absorbed the lessons learned. And after each of these periods of excess, we as a nation felt ashamed and tried to make up for the abuses, with monetary payments in some cases, with apologies, with new laws and new protections. And although we have not yet entered the period of regret and atonement this time around, it is already obvious that we have been for some time in one of those periods of regrettable excess. Former Supreme Court Justice William Brennan commented on this cycle once, writing, "After each perceived security crisis ended, the United States has remorsefully realized that the abrogation of civil liberties was unnecessary, but it has proven unable to prevent itself from repeating the error when the next crisis came along." There are also reasons for concern this time around that what we are experiencing may no longer be the first half of a recurring cycle, but rather the beginning of something new. For one thing, this war is predicted by the administration to last for the rest of our lives. So we are told that the conditions of national threat that have been used by other presidents to justify arrogations of power will persist in near perpetuity. Some have expressed the view that over time it will begin to resemble the war against drugs. That is, it will become a more or less permanent struggle that occupies a significant part of our law enforcement and security agenda from now on. If that is the case, then when, if ever, does this encroachment on our freedoms die a natural death? For another thing, we have for decades been witnessing the slow and steady accumulation of presidential power. In a global environment of nuclear weapons and Cold War tensions, Congress and the American people accepted ever-enlarging spheres of presidential initiative to conduct intelligence and counterintelligence activities and to allocate our military forces on the global stage. As Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter wrote in a 1952 Supreme Court case, "The accretion of dangerous power does not come in a day. It does come, however slowly, from the generative force of unchecked disregard of the restrictions that fence in even the most disinterested assertion of authority." In that case, President Harry Truman was faced with a dispute with the owners of America's largest steel manufacturers in the midst of the worsening Korean War. In an overreach of presidential power, Truman declared that the U.S. government would simply take over operation of the steel mills. But the court prevented him from following through based on prior congressional legislation governing the matter. A third reason to worry that what we are witnessing is a discontinuity and not another turn of the recurring cycle is that the new technologies of surveillance, long anticipated by novelists like George Orwell and other prophets of the police state, are now more widespread than they have ever been. They give the government a vast new capacity to sweep up and analyze enormous quantities of information and to mine it for intelligence. This adds significant vulnerability to the privacy and freedom of enormous numbers of innocent people, and they do have the potential for shifting the balance of power between the apparatus of the state and the freedom of the individual in ways both subtle and profound. Moreover, these technologies are being widely used not only by the government, but also by corporations and other private entities. And that is relevant to an assessment of the requirements in the Patriot Act for so many corporations, especially in the finance industries, to prepare millions of reports annually for the government on suspicious activities by their customers. It is also relevant to the new flexibility corporations have been given to share information with one another about their customers. The fourth reason for concern is that the threat of additional terror strikes is all too real, and the concerted efforts of terrorist organizations to acquire weapons of mass destruction do create a real imperative to exercise the powers of the executive branch with swiftness and agility. Just as the emergence of nuclear weapons and ICBMs created a new practical imperative in the Cold War that altered the balance of war-making responsibility between Congress and the President. Moreover, there is in fact an inherent power that is conferred by the Constitution to the President to take unilateral action to protect the nation from a sudden and immediate threat, and it is simply not possible to precisely define in legalistic terms exactly when that power is appropriate and when it is not. For example, if in an isolated case, or even in a small number of cases, a president is presented with an opportunity to seize an individual he has good reason to believe is about to cause grave harm to the United States or its citizens, he has the inherent power to act quickly on that information. As vice president, I myself made that very point to President Clinton when he had the opportunity to seize an Al-Qaeda operative who was planning an attack against us. And the president took my advice, though the individual we attempted to capture escaped. But there is a big difference between the exercise of that inherent presidential power in exceptional cases and an effort to silently institute a massive and permanent new pattern that clearly oversteps the boundaries established in the Constitution. The existence of that inherent power cannot be used to justify a gross and excessive power grab lasting for years that produces a serious imbalance in the relationship between the executive and the other two branches of government. There is a final reason to worry that we may be experiencing something more than just another cycle of overreach and regret. This administration has come to power in the thrall of a legal theory that aims to convince us that this excessive concentration of presidential authority is exactly what our Constitution intended. That is, of course, not true. If our founders could see the current state of their generation's handiwork and assess the quality of our generation's stewardship now at the beginning of this 21st century, I am certain they would be amazed at the claims of the current administration. There is simply no question that we continue to face new challenges in the wake of the attack of September 11th and that we must be vigilant in protecting our citizens from harm. But we do not have to break the law or sacrifice our system of government to protect Americans from terrorism. In fact, doing so makes us weaker and more vulnerable. Moreover, it is often the case that an executive branch, beguiled by the pursuit of unchecked power, responds to its own mistakes by reflexively proposing that it be given still more power. Often the request itself is used to mask accountability for mistakes in the use of power it already has made. Some of the worst abuses of individuals by the current administration came when Arab American immigrants were rounded up in the weeks following the 9/11 attacks. This mass mistreatment actually hurt our security in a number of important ways. But first, let's be clear about what happened. This was little more than a cheap and cruel political stunt by then Attorney General John Ashcroft. More than 99% of the mostly Arab background men who were rounded up had merely overstayed their visas or committed some other minor offense as they tried to pursue the American dream just like most immigrants. But they were used as extras in the administration's effort to give the impression that it had caught a large number of bad guys. And many of them were treated horribly and abusively. Consider this example reported in depth by former New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis. Ansar Mehmood, a Pakistani who had overstayed his visa, was arrested in New York on October 3, 2001. The next day, he was briefly questioned by FBI agents who said they had no further interest in him. Then he was shackled in handcuffs, leg irons, and a belly chain and taken to the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. Guards there put two more sets of handcuffs on him and another set of leg irons. One threw Mehmood against a wall. The guards forced him to run down a long ramp, the irons cutting into his wrists and ankles. The physical abuse was mixed with verbal taunts. After 2 weeks, Mehmood was allowed to make a telephone call to his wife. She was not at home, and Mehmood was told that he would have to wait 6 weeks to try again. He first saw her on a visit 3 months after his arrest. All that time, he was kept in a windowless cell in solitary confinement, with two overhead fluorescent lights on all the time. In the end, he was charged with using an invalid Social Security card. He was deported in May 2002, nearly 8 months after his arrest. The faith tradition I share with Ashcroft includes this teaching from Jesus: "Whatsoever you do unto the least of these, you do unto me." And make no mistake, the disgraceful treatment suffered by many of these vulnerable immigrants at the hands of the administration has created deep resentments and hurt the cooperation desperately needed from immigrant communities in the United States and from the security services of other countries. In what is in some ways an even more brazen move, years after the Justice Department rounded up over 1,200 individuals of Arab descent, it still refuses to release the names of the individuals who were detained, even though virtually every one of those arrested has been cleared by the FBI of any connection to terrorism. There is absolutely no national security justification for keeping the name secret. War is lawful violence, but even in its midst, we acknowledge the need for rules. We know that in our wars, there have been dissents from these standards, often the result of spontaneous anger arising out of the passion of battle. But we count on our president to protect us from this kind of violence, not to create the framework that makes it possible. We could look to the chief executive as the point from which redress would come and law would be upheld. That was one of the great prides of our country, humane leadership faithful to the law. What we have now, however, is the result of decisions taken by a president and an administration for whom the best law is no law, as long as law threatens to constrain their political will. And where the constraints of law cannot be prevented or eliminated, then they maneuver it to be weakened by evasion, by delay, by hair splitting, by obstruction, and by failure to enforce on the part of those sworn to uphold the law. In 1999, Israel's highest court was asked to balance the right of individual prisoners against dire threats to the security of its people. Here is what the court declared: "This is the destiny of democracy, as not all means are acceptable to it, and not all practices employed by its enemies are open before it. Although a democracy must often fight with one hand tied behind its back, it nonetheless has the upper hand. Preserving the rule of law and recognition of an individual's liberty constitutes an important component in its understanding of security. At the end of the day, they strengthen its spirit and allow it to overcome its difficulties." The constant violations of civil liberties by the Bush-Cheney administration also promote the false impression that these violations are necessary in order to take every precaution against another terrorist attack. But the simple truth is that the vast majority of the violations have not benefited our security at all. On the contrary, they hurt our security, and they have taken us much further down the road toward an intrusive Big Brother-style government, toward the dangers prophesied by George Orwell in his book 1984, than anyone ever thought would be possible in the United States of America. So what should be done? Well, to begin with, our country ought to find a way to immediately stop its policy of indefinitely detaining American citizens without charges and without a judicial determination that their detention is proper. Such a course of conduct is incompatible with American traditions and values, with sacred principles of due process of law and separation of powers. It is no accident that our Constitution requires in criminal prosecutions a speedy and public trial. The principles of liberty and the accountability of government, at the heart of what makes America unique, require no less. The Bush administration's treatment of American citizens it calls enemy combatants is nothing short of un-American. Second, foreign citizens held in Guantanamo and elsewhere as captured combatants should be protected by the United States under Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, which forbids murder, mutilation, cruel treatment, torture, and humiliating and degrading treatment. Article 3 also prohibits the passing of sentences and the carrying out of executions without previous judgment pronounced by a regularly constituted court, affording all the judicial guarantees which are recognized as indispensable by civilized peoples. Since the conventions were adopted, that has been done in every war until this one, including Vietnam and the Gulf War. If we don't provide this protection, how can we expect American troops captured overseas to be treated with equal respect? We owe this to our sons and daughters who fight to defend freedom in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and elsewhere in the world. Next, our nation's greatness is measured by how we treat those who are the most vulnerable. Non-citizens whom the government seeks to detain should be entitled to some basic rights. The administration must stop abusing the so-called material witness statute. That statute was designed to hold witnesses briefly before they are called to testify before a grand jury. It has been misused by this administration as a pretext for indefinite detention without charge. That is simply not right. The Patriot Act, along with its many excesses, contained a few needed changes in the law. And it is certainly true that many of the worst abuses of due process and civil liberties that are now occurring are taking place under the color of laws and executive orders other than the Patriot Act. Nevertheless, the Patriot Act has turned out to be, on balance, a terrible mistake and has become a kind of Gulf of Tonkin resolution conferring Congress's blessing for this president's assault on civil liberties. Congress missed a golden opportunity when it voted to reauthorize the act, including its most objectionable features, with only minor changes, instead of replacing it with a new, smaller, and more effective law. The politicization of law enforcement in this administration is part of its larger agenda to roll back the changes in government policy brought about by the New Deal and the progressive movement. Toward that end, it is cutting back on civil rights enforcement, women's rights, progressive taxation, the estate tax, access to the courts, Medicare, and much more. It has even begun an effort to force the retirement of U.S. attorneys for what appear to be purely political reasons. In some cases investigated by the new Congress, U.S. attorneys who were praised by members of both parties for their high competence were replaced by individuals whose only apparent qualifications were political connections to the White House. One of those, David C. Iglesias of New Mexico, said that he was pressured to indict prominent Democrats before the 2006 midterm elections by two unnamed New Mexico Republicans. He refused to do so, and the White House approved his firing. But there has been no more bizarre or troubling manifestation of how seriously off track this president's policies have taken America than the profound shocks to our nation's conscience regarding torture. First came those extremely disturbing pictures from Abu Ghraib, which documented the strange forms of physical and sexual abuse and even torture and even murder committed by some of our troops against people taken as prisoners in Iraq, an estimated 90% of them innocent of any charge. As a direct result of the incompetent planning and inadequate troop strength, our young men and women in uniform were put in untenable positions. For example, young reservists assigned to the Iraqi prisons were called up without training or adequate supervision and then instructed by superiors from organizations not in their chain of command to break down prisoners in order to prepare them for interrogation. They were placed in a confusing situation where the chain of command was crisscrossed between intelligence gathering and prison administration, and further confused by unprecedented mixing of military and civilian contractor authority. The soldiers who committed these atrocities are, of course, responsible for their own actions, but they're not the ones primarily responsible for the disgrace that has been brought upon the United States of America. They're not the ones who designed the policy and put it in place. Private Lindy England did not make the decision that the United States would no longer observe the Geneva Conventions. Specialist Charles Grainer was not the architect of the extensive network of U.S. facilities in multiple countries with cold, naked prisoners to be stressed and even tortured to force them to say things that legal procedures might not induce them to say. The policies that laid the groundwork for these atrocities were designed and insisted upon by the Bush White House. Indeed, the president's own legal counsel briefed him specifically on the subject. His Secretary of Defense and the Assistant Secretaries of Defense pushed these cruel departures from historic American standards over the objections of the uniformed military. Members of the Judge Advocates General's Department within the Defense Department were so disturbed and so upset and so opposed to this policy that they took the unprecedented step of coming as a group to seek the help of a private attorney who specializes in human rights in Washington, D.C. As a group, they said to him, "There is a calculated effort to create an atmosphere of legal ambiguity where the mistreatment of prisoners is concerned." Indeed, the secrecy of the program indicates an understanding on the part of its authors that the regular military culture and its mores would not support these activities, and neither would the American public or the world community. That's why they tried to keep it secret. Another implicit acknowledgement of violations of accepted standards of behavior is the process of farming out prisoners to countries less averse to torture and to private contractors who are accountable, apparently, to no one. President Bush himself set the tone for our attitude towards suspects in his State of the Union address in 2003. He noted that more than 3,000 suspected terrorists have been arrested in many countries, and then he added, "And many others have met a different fate. Let's put it this way. They are no longer a problem to the United States and our friends and our allies." He promised to change the tone in Washington, and indeed he did, much for the worse. We now know that, tragically, as many as 37 prisoners may have been murdered while in captivity, though the numbers are difficult to rely upon because in many of the cases involving violent death, there were no autopsies. It is outrageous for the administration to blame its misdeeds on young enlisted personnel from a reserve unit in upstate New York and to claim that this extensive pattern is the work of a few bad apples among enlisted personnel. President Bush should make amends, not only for letting down the young soldiers, who are themselves culpable, but who were clearly forced to wade into a moral cesspool created by the policies of the Bush White House. The perpetrators, as well as the victims, were both placed in their relationship to one another as a result of decisions made in Washington, D.C. Those decisions by the Bush-Cheney administration resulted in behavior that shocked the conscience of Americans and dragged the good name of our country through the mud of Abu Ghraib, Saddam Hussein's former torture prison. Make no mistake, though. The damage done at Abu Ghraib is not only to America's reputation and America's strategic interests, but also to America's spirit. Remember how shocked each of us was when we first saw those hideous images? The natural tendency was at first to recoil from the images, and then to assume that they represented a strange and rare aberration that came about because of a few twisted minds, or, as the Pentagon said, a few bad apples. But not long thereafter, an army survey of prisoner deaths and mistreatment in Iraq and Afghanistan showed a widespread pattern of abuse involving a significant number of military units in many different locations. This pattern of abuse clearly did not spring from a few twisted minds at the lowest ranks of our military enlisted personnel. It came from twisted values and atrocious policies at the highest level of our government. This was done by our leaders. In our name. These horrors were the predictable consequence of policy choices that flowed directly from this administration's contempt for the rule of law. and the dominance they have been seeking is truly not just unworthy of America, it is also an illusory goal in its own right. Our world is unconquerable because the human spirit is unconquerable, and any national strategy based on pursuing the goal of domination is doomed to fail because it generates its own opposition and in the process creates enemies for the would-be dominator. You'll recall the strange and perverted legal memorandum from inside the administration that actually sought to justify torture and to somehow provide a legal rationale for the sadistic activities conducted in the name of the American people. Activities that, according to any reasonable person, would be recognized as offensive to the conscience of humankind. The uproar caused by the disclosure of this legal analysis forced the administration to claim it was throwing the memo out and to dismiss it as irrelevant and overbroad. But the administration still refuses to acknowledge that the memo's original audacious claims that the president can ignore the law are just wrong. Congress was understandably unmoved by these disclaimers and enacted the McCain Amendment, preventing not only what the memo regards as torture, but also cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment of detainees. Despite the threat of a veto, the legislation passed by overwhelming veto-proof majorities in both houses. Rather than see his veto overridden, the president signed the law, but simultaneously issued a signing statement indicating that he would not be bound by the new law. The statement declared that the McCain Amendment would be construed to make it consistent with the president's power as head of the unitary executive and as commander-in-chief, and also in light of the constitutional limitations on the judicial power. Are we still routinely torturing helpless prisoners? And if so, does it feel right that we as American citizens are not outraged by the practice? And does it feel right to have no ongoing discussion of whether or not this abhorrent medieval behavior is being carried out in the name of the American people? The administration must disclose all of its interrogation policies, including those used by the military in Iraq and Afghanistan, and those employed by the CIA at any detention centers operated outside the United States, as well as all of the analyses related to the adoption of those policies. We deserve to know what and why it's being done in our name. In making their analysis, the administration lawyers concluded that the president, whenever he is acting in his role as commander-in-chief, is largely above and immune from the rule of law. At least we don't have to guess what our founders would have to say about that bizarre and un-American theory. In addition, the broad analysis regarding the commander-in-chief's powers that they had asserted has explicitly not been disavowed. And the view of the aforementioned memo that it was within the commander-in-chief's power to order any interrogation techniques necessary to extract information most certainly contributed to the atmosphere that led to the atrocities committed against the Iraqis at Abu Ghraib. President Bush rewarded the principal author of this legal monstrosity with a seat on the U.S. Court of Appeals. This president episodically poses as a uniter and healer. If he really had any desire to play that role, then he would have condemned Rush Limbaugh among his strongest political supporters, who said publicly that the torture at Abu Ghraib was a brilliant maneuver, and that the photos were good old American pornography, and that the actions portrayed were simply those of people having a good time and needing to blow some steam off. Differences of degree are important when the subject is torture. The apologists for what has happened do have points that should be heard and clearly understood. It is a fact that every culture and every political system sometimes expresses itself in cruelty. It is also undeniably true that other countries have tortured and do torture more routinely and far more brutally than has ours. George Orwell wrote in 1984 about a fictional totalitarian regime based on that of Soviet Russia and characterized life in it as a boot stamping on a human face forever. That was the ultimate culture of cruelty, so ingrained, so organic, so systematic that everyone in it lived in terror, even the terrorizers. That was the nature and degree of state cruelty in Saddam Hussein's Iraq as well. We know these things, and we need not reassure ourselves and should not congratulate ourselves that our society is less cruel than some others. However, it is worth noting that many are less cruel than ours. What we do now, in reaction to documented atrocities like those committed at Abu Ghraib, will determine a great deal about who we are at the beginning of the 21st century. It is important to note that just as the abuses of the prisoners flowed directly from the policies of the Bush White House, those policies, in turn, not only flowed from the instincts of the president and his advisors, they also found support in shifting attitudes on the part of some in our country in response to the outrage and fear generated by the attack of September 11th. The president exploited and fanned those fears, but some otherwise sensible and level-headed Americans expressed them as well. I remember reading soberly written essays asking publicly whether or not the prohibitions against torture were any longer relevant or desirable. The same grotesque misunderstanding of what is really involved in torture was responsible for the tone in the memo from Alberto Gonzalez, who wrote on January 25, 2002, that the attack of 9/11 renders obsolete Geneva's strict limitations on questioning of enemy prisoners and renders quaint some of its provisions. Quaint? Is progress in civilization a quaint idea? Is it truly naive to think that the United States will continue to lead that progress? Now we have long since seen the pictures. We have long since learned the news. We cannot unlearn it. It is part of us. So the important question now is, what will we do about torture in our name? Stop it? Yes, of course, but that means demanding all of the facts, not covering them up as some now charge the administration is doing. One of the whistleblowers at Abu Ghraib, Sergeant Samuel Provance, told the news media that he was being punished for telling the truth. There is definitely a cover-up. I feel like I am being punished for being honest, he said. The president himself placed the blame for the horrific consequences of his policies on the young privates and corporals and sergeants, who may well be culpable as individuals for their actions, but were certainly not responsible for the policies that led to America's strategic catastrophe in Iraq. And none of the Pentagon or White House officials responsible for this horrible and felonious betrayal of American values has yet been held accountable. The right-wing commentator, Laura Ingraham, said, "The average American out there loves the show 24, okay? They love Jack Bauer, and they love 24. In my mind, that's as close to a national referendum that it's okay to use tough tactics against high-level Al-Qaeda operatives as we're going to get." How perfect, and how sad a comment on what happens when we no longer have a robust